Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. At a high school dance in 1964, 17-year-old Sandra London met a bright, handsome, well-mannered Catholic boy, 18-year-old Gerald John Schaefer. They hung out all the time and soon fell in love. But after a year, as young lovers will, they went their separate ways. She thought she'd never see him again. Then in 1972 came the screaming headlines, 6 dead, 28 maybe, and the ghoulish stories about the smiling cop turned sadistic killer and corpse-loving fiend, hoarding mementos of his mutilated victims and writing it all up in feverish prose. Absolutely unbelievable. She was appalled that crimes like this could be committed by anyone, much less someone she had known intimately. Remember, those were the days before the term serial killer existed, before Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, and Jeffrey Dahmer so irrevocably showed us what it meant. In those days, Schaefer's type of crime was not only unnamed, it was unheard of. Between March and July of 1989, Schaefer sent her the stories included in two sections of Killer Fiction, Whores and Stark Stories, selections from the stories and drawings used as evidence in his 1973 murder trial are included in the section, Actual Fantasies. A limited edition of the volume comprising these three sections was copyrighted and published in June of 1989. "I'm not writing nonfiction," explained the literary madman. "It's killer fiction, a new genre where the writer takes violence as an artistic medium and instead of glorifying it, makes the reader see it as the cruel and horrid act it is in reality. I don't represent violence as good or bad, merely as it is. I let the reader conclude that violence is a socially negative force, not to be reveled in." Thus he expounded his grim, postmodern aesthetic. The truth about his crimes did not matter to her as much as the chance to take a look into his deranged mind. Somehow she managed to overcome her revulsion to his sexually violent obsessions enough to continue documenting them. His sexism, his racism, his fury at every living being in the world, including himself, his boast of rape, sodomy, murder, even necrophilia, these she managed to tolerate by reminding herself that this was important data. And so she decided to set aside her own personal distaste for the ugliness of the work and focus on presenting it in all its twisted glory and leave it to the audience to tell her what it was. The book that we're featuring this evening is Killer Fiction, Stories That Convicted the Ex-Cop of Murder, with my special guest, journalist and author, Sandra London. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Sandra London.
Hi, how are you doing, Dan?
I'm very good. Thank you very much for joining us today to talk about this incredible true crime classic, Killer Fiction.
Well, I'm honored.
Now, well, thank you. I'm honored to have you on the program once again. Let's talk about 1964, as we did in the introduction. You were 17 years old. Tell us just a little bit before we get into this examination of what Gerald Schaefer wrote and sent you and wanted to have out there for everyone to read. Tell us how it all started in 1964. Tell us a little bit about this relationship.
Okay. First, I have to correct you. It's Gerard. It's always Gerard.
Okay.
It's not Gerald. And most people are familiar with the word Gerald, so they usually call him Gerald because they heard it before. But it's Gerard. So anyway, there I was. I went to Stranahan High School in Fort Lauderdale, and I was at a dance at my school. And when I saw this handsome young boy that I had never seen before, and so the reason I didn't see him is because he went to the Catholic school in town, and he we met literally at the punch bowl. We both had dates, but somehow or another we wound up chatting over the punch bowl, and told him my name. And so he went through the Fort Lauderdale phone book and looked up everyone by that last name and called them to see if he could find me that way. And he did find me. And I thought it was kind of flattering, you know, and cute, you know, at the time. And, you know, it's only after years and years of retrospection that I put a different kind of different color on the whole procedure.
Now, you had this short relationship with him. What was it about this relationship that why did it end? And then tell us what happened afterwards in terms of your writing career.
Okay. Well, it was 1 year from beginning to end. And why did we break up? I was just a kid. Now, look, I was a kid, number one. Number two, nobody ever heard of serial killers. And if they had them, they sure didn't reach the level of awareness that we are accustomed to today. And another thing is, when people say stuff, you don't really take it to heart. You don't really think, oh, yeah, oh, my God. You know, people just say stuff, and you're like, uh-huh, you know. So we had a regular love affair, and I got to say this right off because everybody always thinks they know what they're talking about, and they're wrong. I had sex with John, and it was as plain vanilla as you can imagine. There was nothing funny about having sex with John Schaefer. And I know it's hard to believe. We learn these theorems, and we learn these overall generalities when we study the textbooks, and then to me, all that learning gets away, it gets in the way and blocks the case that's standing right before you. So that's one thing I have learned to strive for. I study the literature, but I try very hard to set it aside when it comes to the case before me and allow it to be what it is. So there you go. John was an outdoorsman. He liked to go fishing, hunting, and he had a boat and liked to go out on the boat. His family was very respectable. They were belonged to the yacht club and the country club, and he had one girlfriend before me for 5 years, and she was a debutante. So he was her debutante escort at all the high society functions in town. So that was the boy I knew. He liked to play golf. He took me out shooting and taught me how to handle a weapon. He took me out on the boat into the Gulf Stream. We got stranded on a sidebar once and didn't get home until 4 a.m. in the morning, and my parents rather freaked out. But in general, it was just teenage dating, going to dances, football games, and what like that. Toward the end, he became a drag. He was upset. And instead of going out and having fun, it would be like I was his psychotherapist or something, and he wanted to talk about his problems so much. And the picture that remains in my mind is just this one vignette that we used to go out in his old car. We had a blanket. We'd go out on the beach and have sex and stuff. So in this vignette that presaged the end of this, we're sitting out on the beach, but we've got the blanket over our shoulders, and we're huddled under it like two little lost children or something, and he's just crying. Well, he's crying and upset because he is being pestered by unwanted, intrusive thoughts of killing women. And he wants to kill women. And I don't know, he's telling this to me because I'm his closest companion. But I want you to understand that I'm not in any position to do anything that the casual armchair observer might think I should have done.
Right.
Years later, I consulted with the homicide chief the chief of detectives there in Fort Lauderdale told him that John had told me he wanted to kill women. I said a lot of people had accused me of failing to call the cops on him, and they reassured me that no such thing was possible. Cops do not respond to reports of someone saying they want to kill. Cops only respond
right.
when a crime has been committed. And if I were to call the cops on him, they would not take a report.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, it didn't dawn on me to call the cops on him because I didn't think he was a serial killer.
No.
I just thought he was my boyfriend who was supposed to take me out and show me a good time, and he was a drag, pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Now, after this 1964, we're into 1965, and you
right.
don't hear anything more about, you thought you'd never see him again. You don't hear anything else from Gerard for till 1972, and you see the screaming headlines. But in the interim, you become a
mm-hmm.
writer. Tell us what kind
mm-hmm.
of writer you are, and tell us a little bit about
mm-hmm.
that writing career, and
mm-hmm.
then what happens in 1972. What's the headline you read, and then tell us a little bit about that reaction to
okay.
that headline.
As far as me writing, it started in third grade when they picked me out for a special class in creative writing, and there was only five of us in the school, and they take us in there and let us creative write. My forte was poetry, and I edited my high school literary magazine, and then when I went to college and got a degree in literature, our graduation ceremony consisted of me presenting a 9-page poem I had written about our times, 1968, which was a pretty interesting time. And anyway,
sure.
there was that. After that, I went on mostly interested in being a singer and had bands, stuff like that, continue to write poetry. To earn a living, I was working for attorneys and doing legal research and writing. And eventually that phase drifted into technical writing along the way. So that was the kind of background I had. I had been in singing, show business and everything, and I got tired of hearing this refrain, which goes, "There's no pay, but it's great exposure." I don't know if any of us have ever heard that one.
Oh, yeah.
But I swear mm-hmm. to God, I was never going to, you know, I'm like Scarlett O'Hara, you know, I'm never going to hear that again, you know.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so I set off toward writing, and that occurred in 1989 when I decided to enter true crime. As far as writing, I'd been doing legal writing. Everything is under a structure called work. For hire, which means you don't put your name on it. They pay you to write something for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was work for hire. So come 89, then I was like, okay, there was a crazy little thing called Reaganomics, And for a whole year, I wasn't able to get the contracts that I'd always gotten. Every time I pitched a contract to a client, I got it. And all of a sudden this year, I couldn't do anything right. And I was like, what? It didn't dawn on me it was the economy. I thought it was me. So by early 89, I said, look at this. They killed Ted Bundy, and everybody was going crazy. Bundy, Bundy, Bundy. And serial killers, serial killers, serial killers. It was in everywhere you looked. And I said, well, what is this? And I read that book by Ann Rule, The Stranger Beside Me, and I said, shucks. I said, I can write better than that. And I said, plus she barely knew that guy. I knew a serial killer a lot more than that. And that was the thought process that led me to contact Gerard John Schaefer in prison on February 7th, 1989. And so that was the starting gun.
What did you think when you, in 1972 and 73, when Gerard's trial was being conducted, what did you think at the time?
Okay.
I mean, as we fast forward to 1989, but what did you think at the time?
I didn't stumble upon that myself. My sister and my mother hurled it at me violently and accusingly in a way. Look at this. You know, this is what happened to that boyfriend of yours. I don't know. That was the way it hit me. They threw it at me. They threw it in my face. I don't know. I read it. I never heard of anything like that. I was not a true crime lover. I never watched the whodunits on TV. I never took interest in murder mysteries. I didn't care anything about crime. Really, I loved horses and poetry and music. Those were my passions. And, of course, I lived in Fort Lauderdale at the beach, so there was quite a lot of beach bunny in me. And then I went to a new college, Florida's honor college. It's called an experiment in education back at the time. And there was no set curriculum, and there was no grades. You just had to jump in there and really do, or it was pass or fail. So there was 100 in our class, and only 33 finally graduated out of that 100 students. So at that process, I learned to structure my own studies. And theories like go from the particular to the general, go from the general to the particular. So when I set out to do Schaefer, I said, this is a serial killer, so I need to read all the literature on serial killers. I need to consult the experts, and I need to study some more serial killers so I know how to compare. And so I contacted the FBI, and I said, I'm going to study this serial killer, and I wanted some help. And they referred me to Roy Hazelwood, who became my personal mentor. And Roy Hazelwood was so good to me over the years. They have these white papers that they issue to FBI agents. And he sent me the list of them. He said, any of them you want, let me know. I'll send them to you. And I had his home number to call him, consult him anytime I needed to. And he visited me in my home. He had me as a special guest at seminars and backstage at a murder trial. He had me meet him there. And so that was a big influence over the way I went about this. And I'm going to boil it down. Of course, that's the longest story in the world. So I'm trying to only touch the real plot points. The first foremost thing he told me is exactly what they told Clarice in the movie, which was don't ever tell him anything personal because he'll find a way to use it against you. Wow. And the second principle was do not respond emotionally to anything he says because he is going to be trying to get a reaction out of you, and you must keep a deadpan demeanor. And those two things guided me. And the part about the deadpan demeanor, that is what really drove Schaefer into the frenzy that became Killer Fiction, because he kept trying to shock me and disgust me, assault me with this stuff he was writing. It was written at me. And so I held to that, do not respond. And so there you go. That's the biggest dynamic of that whole thing right there in a nutshell.
What was this opening introduction to him, a reintroduction to Gerard, saying, listen, you remember me.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of the conditions that he agreed to, that he wanted as part of the agreement between you two? Tell us a little bit about what he expected, what he wanted from you.
A grandiose and narcissistic personality as he is. I mean, he would say anything more, but he couldn't resist me no matter what. You know, I was the one that had the power over him. And I wrote to him and I said, hi, remember me? And I said, I've become a writer, and would you like to collaborate in a book about your life and crimes? And he responded back, how could I not remember you? My love for you burns like a cold blue flame, and it still burns. So I'm like, I'm not in love with you, so anyway, you want to do a book or what, you know? And, he had a lot of grandiose ideas, and the book was a matter of him trying to manipulate me and me manipulating him, because he wanted the gratification of the sexual attention, and I wanted a story, and the story I wanted was a story of guilt. And I want to know what you did and why you did it. And so I played to his vanity. We were writing, oh, you're such a good writer, John. But then I would challenge him. I say, you know what? Your characters are a lot alike. They're kind of wooden, really stick figures. I say, why don't you try to bring out something more real in a character? Oh, my God. So he writes to real death row inmates in Virginia and says his name's Crystal Beavers, and he's a 16-year-old prom queen who is organization called Justice Now. And that means all you people on death row need to go ahead and get executed quickly. And so he started writing to these death row inmates in that tone, very sexy, flirtatious, and challenging. And he got that whole death row in Virginia in an uproar until it became a behavior issue. And then the monitor of death row, Joe O'Dell, wrote to me and said, all right, Crystal Beavers, what do you think you're doing? And I wrote back to him, and I'm like, you know what, there is no Crystal Beavers, it's Gerard John Schaefer, and, so forth. Well, it turns out Joe O'Dell had been down there in prison with Gerard John Schaefer in Florida State Prison previously, and he knew him. He knew him. He'd been in prison with him. And he knew some of these other characters that were trying to get me to pay attention to them. I don't know how to put it, but so O'Dell, that became a whole other thing with him, Schaefer, trying to get them all worked up in a frenzy, and Schaefer's like, oh, is that real enough for you?
When you talk about him adding realistic details to his stories. But what was the premise of this? Again, it's called Killer Fiction. What was his, what did he decide that would be? What were the rules of this killer fiction? What was the purpose of this killer fiction?
Well, that was, I guess, determined by me as the editor. How it started was I asked him, maybe it was that first letter, if not, maybe the third letter, fourth letter, do you still write those stories, you know, that his case was based on? For the new listener, I'll just quickly recap. When he was arrested, his mother's house was raided, and there was a stack of manuscripts in a closet that had been John's closet when he was in high school and lived there. They were seized and put in evidence, and those are the writings that convicted him of murder. Okay? Now, you would think, logically, that to be evidence in a murder, it would have to say, you know, I killed X victim and here's how or what I did. And none of that was of that nature at all. All those had been written many years before the crime. And I think, after thinking about this quite a lot, I think the genre would best be described as jack-off fantasies, because, specifically I say that, because there were so many of them that just trailed off, that he didn't finish. Okay, so it would always be after he got to the part that was most interesting to him. And then the writing would just drip off and say he'd lose interest in it. So Schaefer was convicted on the basis of his writings. So in his Latter Day Project, I think that William Hirons, the Catch Me Killer, was very astute when he said, I see what he's trying to do is more or less muddy the water and create the illusion that all he's ever done was write these stories. So therefore, you know, he's not guilty of murder. And I think there may have been some of that. I also think that he was just, as part of his sexual disorder, his compulsions, that he did these things. He did these writings. It was a kind of a masturbation type thing to do, even if there was no audience. But since for this project, the audience was me, then therefore everything he wrote was targeted at me. If he were not being restrained by cuffs and chains and steel and stone, these are the things that he would be perpetrating. And since he was restrained, the only way he could do it was by writing.
When he start writing these stories to you,
yeah,
what amount of parallel truth was there from you looking at the information? You knew about the trial. You knew about what Schaefer says is just stuff that he wrote long before that has no relation to the truth, and yet he was convicted, and of course. Part of this killer fiction is also revenge against those prosecutors, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, right. That's right. The judges and everyone, and the media and everyone. And he did issue real death threats against all these people and get punished for it. He got put in the hole for sending out hits against the prosecutor and the judge. So he was dead serious about that. He had a record of it, you know. It was on his sheet that he had done that by the time I met him again.
But what was his, what was the, not the premise, but what was the purpose of this as well? He was framed with this trial. So with the killer fiction, he wanted to do what in terms of connection to the truth? He said this is killer fiction, but what did he want to do in the killer fiction writings?
He wanted to prove that he's just a writer. He's like Stephen King. That to put a different light on the things that he did write. Then he said, well, I can write more and show you what a good writer I was. But really, anyone who ever read any of his stuff and me all kept saying to John, John, you really do have a talent. Why don't you write about something else? Right? But he couldn't tear himself away from these pathological musings. So it was a pose. If he really were, you know, quite inspired as a writer, surely something other would have caught his attention in this journey through life. But no, it always was narrowly focused. He couldn't stop writing about those things. In my research into his past, the people that were locked up to him, with him, there I was able to reach a former cellmate, and he was there pre-trial and everything. And Schaefer, he told me, Schaefer was always writing, and he was writing these stories, and he said, read them to us. He'd read them, they're horrifying. You know, death, murder stories. And then he got charged, and the inmate said that he took all those stories and tore them up and threw them away. So any kind of madness that affects his mind does not go so far that he can't tell reality from fantasy. There are people who are so deranged that they really can't tell. But a successful serial killer has to be able to pull himself together and to do the MO necessary to get away with the murder so he can do it again. So you've got a different type of mind at work there besides just someone who's you know, morbidly fascinated on death.
Sure. What he talked about descriptions also was evidence of his narcissistic personality in that it was all about him. He was the biggest and best. He cites other people saying that he was the best, the most skilled serial killer.
The greatest.
And also, when he talks about that he's an excellent lover. He's basically a romantic person that is experienced in S&M and bondage, but also just in the ways of life. So in these all of these stories, he's a sexual stud.
Mm-hmm.
He can please women. He knows everything. He's a uber-intelligent person. And that's evidenced by the crimes that he has. So these stories are all filled with...
And how he outsmarts all the stupid cops.
Oh, certainly, yeah. It's like having a lot of...
Let's go back to his real-life experiences as a police officer there in Wilton Manors, Florida. He was a snitch even then. He would go to the chief and tell him what officers were slacking off and not writing enough tickets and laying around the donut shop and that sort of thing, you know. You got the three strands. It's like the fatal triad, you know, that they mentioned about homicide. So this is the other side. This is the fatal triad to have in prison, you know. He killed girls underage. He was a cop, and he was a snitch. So, you know, I mean, you really can't get much lower than that. So all of his bluster and everything, it was some of that must have had to have been built up from having to live in prison for quite a while. You know, to build up a front that they could possibly offer some protection. But his activities as a snitch were so well known in a very small community. I don't care how big the prison is, you know. And they got a hotline, you know. And so he got a job as a law clerk. And then he would go and get a defendant and debrief him about everything about his crime. And then lo and behold, those details would wind up on the desk of the prosecutor.
Yeah.
Whoa, wait a minute. Now, how long do you think he's going to be able to continue operating like that? See? So then
yeah,
the next trick he did that got him killed, actually, was when there was an actual team of legal consultants who had a hold of a defendant, and he weaseled them away from him. He told them he'd do it for less. And so he stole their client away from them. And then again, he got him convicted, got him sent to death row. And his Schaefer's classification officer is my source for this, so that those boys were very, very popular inmates, and so that is what he believes accounted for his being murdered. Before he was murdered, his cell was set on fire 3 different times.
Wow.
But it wasn't because he was a snitch. I mean, it wasn't because he was a cop. It wasn't because he killed girls. It was because he was a snitch. And he just, it was a part of him that could not be controlled. Had to do it.
In this killer fiction, he has a main philosophy. Someone that he targets, that he hates more than anyone else, and he feels it's his mission to eliminate these people.
Yeah. You talking about whores?
We're talking about prostitutes, yes. What is
yes.
there?
That's what he calls them, whores. He doesn't call them prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all right. Let's go back to something I mentioned earlier in my interview where he and I were sitting out under the blanket talking about him wanting to kill women. Let's bear down on that for a minute and unpack. There's more to it. He told me at that time, as we sat out there, that he had already planned to kill a girl. He gave me the details. She lived on the end of his dead-end street at the Avenue side, not the dead end side. And so he said that they took out the garbage on Tuesday, so he pulled his station wagon up right by her house and waited for her to take out the trash. And he had the accoutrements in the station wagon, which he mentioned to me, rope and concrete block, a rifle, and I'm trying to think what else, but anyway, a blanket to wrap her up in. So he was lurking there waiting for her to come out so he could take her, hit her on the head, wrap her up in the blanket, tie it, carry her into the road, put her in his daddy's old cabin cruiser, take her out into the Gulf Stream, then shoot her and dump her. And except his father came driving by in his car and pulled up and said, "Hey, John, what you doing?" And John's like, "Oh, nothing." And so he canceled the mission, and he didn't do it. And that's what he told me in 1964. And so then when we were working on this book, you know, every now and then I'd make little allusions to the things that he had told me before, but I would never say what it was. Then when we sat down in a person-to-person meeting, he asked me, "You've mentioned this before, what were you talking about?" And I told him what I just told you, what he said. And he said, "That's interesting." He says, "Because that's not what happened." And from that, he wrote the story Gator Bait. And he said that is what really happened. And in that, he describes hiding in Wade. He enters her house and waits for her to come home from a date, kiss her date goodnight at the door, and come in by herself. Now, I want to point out something at this point, if you're following his twisted logic. His reason for doing this was because she was a whore, and she was pulling him away from his righteous Catholic nature. Every time he went jogging by her house, her sitting out there showing off her body, the power of her was enough to derange him from his proper goodness. Okay? That is the way he experienced it. So he called her a whore. Now look, here's what she was doing. Sitting out in her backyard in shorts and a halter sunbathing. I mean, who doesn't do that? You see? So
yeah.
She didn't have to be a whore. He called her a whore. Okay? And then the night that he claims he attacked her, she didn't do anything whorey. She went out on a date. She kissed the guy goodnight and came in by herself.
Yeah.
See, so it isn't, you have to understand, it wasn't necessarily real whore. It was a psychological mechanism that he would use to characterize someone as being deserving, as a vent for his hatred, his disgust. He describes what he did to her. At any rate, he assaulted her. Let's put it that way. It was vulgar and disgusting. But he didn't kill her. And she continued to live. But the title of the story is Gator Bait, because he said, if you didn't do what I said, that I'll cut you up and you'll be gator bait by morning.
Most of this writing, too, is characterized by this this violence that he purports upon, that he rains down on these people, but also the idea of his, again, that this is not so uncommon, the idea of sex slaves, people that will do everything that he wants them to do.
Yeah.
Yet at the same time, he says contradictory things, like the one woman said something about, and he thought it was quite genuine, pleading for her life, something about her faith in Jesus, and he hesitated. He said he hesitated, but otherwise, if they said, express something about their faith, he would just kill them quickly. That's all. So he's very contradictory into, when you mentioned about justification, saying that they were whores, they were prostitutes, but in the case that you just mentioned, that wasn't the case. But he's also brags about being so open-minded and experienced in the S&M lifestyle that it doesn't make much sense to
there's
be
a lot
prudish
more
in
stuff
one area.
Wrote I didn't put in this book. And when I get ready to do the second edition of this book, I'm also going to come out with another volume in which he goes into some other things. Well, at the time, I took it as just complete fantasy. In the interval, we've had Jeffrey Epstein and other related cases come to life, and there was a operative who was sent in on me and who tried to work me to my detriment for at least 10 years. And there came a point where he revealed to me that he had been invited to go on this offshore trip out, and it involved recreational murder. And that is what Schaefer was writing about in these stories I didn't necessarily include in Killer Fiction. There are a whole bunch of more stories. And they revolve around the idea that the women or girls were sex trafficked, and then whenever they were used up, that the privilege of killing them would be sold it would be part of what he called the freak trade. Well, I didn't publish that stuff. I never heard anything like that before. And in the intervening years, it's kind of creepy that, you know, I really didn't question him about it, like what really happened about that, what do you really know or anything. I just kept on and encouraging him to write more. You see, I wanted the data, and I had to divorce myself from my natural personal reaction to it. Now, I'd like to talk for a second about the thing you were picking up on, which was contradictoriness. And I want to say that when Elton Schwartz took his case to defend him, he was going around trying to talk to anyone who ever knew him, and he commented for the record that he thought Schaefer must have a split personality, because everyone who knew him saw no indication of any of this kind of a character. And in those days, we did not have the diagnosis of multiple personality disorder, which has now become dissociative identity disorder. However, from my dealing with Schaefer in real life, and going on day to day with, you know, activities of daily living and so forth, I would have to say I believe that he did have a dissociative identity disorder, because he had clearly contradictory identities, and he would switch. And I have letters from him in which he would switch on the same page. And we had, there was a lag there with the body of research and psychological theory. We had to kind of come around to being able to interpret his personality in those terms. But I do think it's important. And I want to say about myself that in dealing with a person who really is dissociative, it's not an excuse like you're a Ken Bianchi. It's real. Mm-hmm. And I would also say it was real in Danny Rowling. But if you have to do that, eventually you or I, let's just leave it to me, I had to develop what I call a multiple interface, to where whenever this character would come at me, I would have to immediately respond on that frequency and don't really make any reference to the other contradictory presentations. Don't confront him with that. Because it's one thing that will drive a fragile person into a spasm of lack of control is when you break the fantasy. Okay, so if his fantasy right now is that he's a framed ex-cop, you don't just really want to just jerk him out of that and all of a sudden remind him that he claims to be the greatest killer of women in the century. You just kind of have to be reactive to where he right. is. And I say that because of what you call trial and error. I say that because I made mistakes. Okay? And so it wasn't that I was so good at this or anything like that. It's that I had to do it. And so I tried, you know, saying you're a liar and look what you said yesterday and all that kind of stuff. And eventually I had to get practical and deal with what was in front of me. Does that make sense?
Certainly. I can understand to a certain degree by interviewing a psychopathic killer for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a goal, and I believe he had a goal.
Mm-hmm.
They were different goals, though.
Mm-hmm.
But I did have to act like nothing he said to me shocked me.
Oh, that's right.
I had to do that because it seems very, very similar in the disgusting nature. There seems
mm-hmm.
to be an envelope that this guy, he claims to be, this is just another genre of a fiction where he's pushing the envelope, the disgusting envelope.
Yeah.
I'm very aware of that as well. I think they're trying to see how far they can go, and they do realize that it's far past anybody's acceptance. But they want to see, again, you mentioned reaction, and reaction is what he wants from this killer fiction and from every letter that he sent you. That's evidence. That's evident in the book itself.
So when he started right off, he was being really, really hateful and ugly toward women.
Mm-hmm.
And I tolerated it. I built up a tolerance for it somehow. It didn't just stab me in the gut every time I read it. I'd be able
right.
to handle it. He got that way about homosexuals. He was real vicious about that. He even got that way about Muslims. I guess he was prescient, but he went off on Muslims. And, you know, I managed to handle it with an even keel and keep working. And then he started in on the blacks, and it broke me. I snapped, and I took what he wrote me, and I balled it up and sent it. I scribbled all over it and sent it back and said, "This is disgusting." And he got so excited, and he was like, "Oh, finally got a reaction from the media queen," you know. And I was like, oh, no, you know, that's exactly what Hazelwood warned you about, you know.
mm-hmm.
But once I went through that, that is when I decided it was even more important that I publish it. Now, I want to tell you something else. I was working for an attorney at the time, and his law office was a First Amendment law office, represented like the New York Times and other papers in defense actions, right?
Right.
But he was an expert, and he also taught constitutional law at college. So when I got this put together manuscript, I asked him if he would look at it and tell me, what is this? And what should I do with it? And we discussed, was it pornography? And he said it wasn't pornography, because pornography by the courts was almost always visuals, that they
right.
did not bother with straight text as far as how pornographic it might be. So he said he
right.
wouldn't worry about that. And he said the most curious thing to me, Dan. He said, if you don't publish this, you will be doing serious harm to the First Amendment. And I was like, what? What? And he said, you are obligated to publish this. And if you take the role of censoring it, then you are internalizing the oppression of the First Amendment. So that's something I don't think anybody's ever charged anyone with, but that's what happened along the way to publishing this. I consulted, and then that was what I was advised. That was my legal counsel, that if I didn't publish it, I was harming the First Amendment. Well, you know, Schaefer wrote this stuff in Florida State Prison, but when I typeset it and sent it back to him, it was seized and called pornographic filth, and he was thrown in the hole for 30 days for having it.
And what did they say to you? I know what they did to him, but what
They said, you're not a real journalist. And I said, oh, yes, I am. And I sent them the letters of incorporation of my publishing company, Media Queen. LLC. And I said, this is a Georgia corporation. Excuse me. I said, I have a corporation, I'm a journalist. And then they said, you are under investigation. And you won't be allowed in the prisons until we complete our investigation. I said, okay, fine. I says, why don't I come up there and meet with you so you can investigate me? And they said, no, that's not how it works. So that went along, and they kicked me out of Florida State Prison. And then they transferred Schaefer down to Belgrade, which is a lower security, and it was down there so he could go to a hearing. And while he was there, they let me in to visit him at Belgrade. And so that way I got, quote unquote, on his visiting list. Okay. So when he was sent back to Florida State Prison, there I was on his list. See?
Wow.
Well, that made them extremely angry. So they told, I was in Atlanta, I called, said I'm going to head down there and visit him. I just wanted to check, is he available to receive visits? No, come on down, everything's fine. Come on down. And I come on down, I wait in the line, I get up there, and they say, well, sorry, Miss London, you're not allowed to enter this prison. I said, what? I called yesterday, you know.
Right.
So it went from there. It went on.
Now the correspondence you had with Gerard John Schaefer lasted quite a while, but the tone of these letters changed dramatically from the beginning to the in sort of midpoint, and then at the end. Tell us about the change in the correspondence and why.
Oh, you put it in such a sane way, you know. it was pretty crazy. Well, he went along, sending me all this stuff, and I had a meeting with him in person, and I said, look here, John. I says, this is stupid. I says, you're not a real serial killer, just writing all this dirty stuff and sending it to me, and I don't want to read it anymore, and I don't want to be bothered with you. And then he's like, oh, really? And he's like, well, you will miss out on your chance of a lifetime to have a real serial killer, and, you know, and all this. And I'm like, yeah, uh-huh. At that point, he offered up Otis Toole, whom he had conned into working with me by telling him I was going to send him money, which was a lie. And so he says, oh, I've got Otis Toole for you. Isn't that great? You can have a real serial killer. And that went off on another tangent. As for him, he started the next phase of his assault. And this one you would describe as, I'll prove to you that it's worth your time to stick around with me. And his ever illusory goal was his appeal. He had an appeal. Schaefer had 20 appeals. He'd gone all the way to the United States Supreme Court.
Right.
So he said, oh, I've got an appeal. And when my appeal's over, I'll give you everything. I'll give you, you know, blah, blah, blah. So just stick around. And so that was that phase. And during that phase, he sent me things that were more and more incriminating and statements that were more and more in the first person and fact-based. And finally, I said to him, John, okay, that's it. I'm convinced you're a serial killer. Okay, so that was fine, except for his other personality. Okay, and that was where we started the next phase, which was to threaten me and threaten my child. I had a personal friendship with a touring musician that I never mentioned to him. He sent me a letter with that musician's tour dates in it and said he's not safe either. He sent people in on me personally to drop off threatening messages, tuck them in the windshield wiper of my car. And he also started a program of sending out all these statements. He found willing publishers, for example, Fatal Visions in Australia, and they published a curse that he put on me. He wrote this long, elaborate, satanic curse against me. It's still out there somewhere. And, I've got to tell you this. This is just terrible. One day I got a call from Roy Hazelwood. Oh, hi, Roy. Good to hear from you. Well, he says, not so good. He says, so what do you think our boy's up to now? And I said, oh, no. And he said, oh, yes. Schaefer had sat down, and he had written to every cop shop that he could find in his book of cop shops, and sent them a statement saying that contact Sandra London, media queen, to find out details of homicides in your jurisdiction. Sandra London is close personal friends on an intimate relationship with Roy Hazelwood. Okay, and when Roy told me that, I like to died. I like to died right then and there. I'm like, oh, no. I never told him anything. He says, I know, I know. And he said, I'm not blaming you, but I just thought you ought to know. You know, wow. And I was so ashamed, and I was so embarrassed. And this is the kind of stuff he was doing. You know, and it was just that Roy Hazelwood was big-minded enough, and he knew me well enough, that he didn't just drop a bomb on me or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
When Schaefer sent those letters threatening your daughter, threatening that he had the connections in prison to be able to do this, to reach out to you and your family to be able to do this, and as you say, you had evidence he could do that. What was the reason behind that?
When we talked about contradiction, calling him a serial killer.
Yeah, but at one point in there, he wants to be known as a serial killer.
Exactly. That's what I was talking about, dissociation. See?
Was there any merit to him
when
he says that
you have to do some brain surgery on your own brain, because the normal brain wants to resolve inconsistencies and say, this is the truth, that is a lie. This is true, that is false. And the mind wants to settle down. And the mind wants to make up its mind. The mind wants to come to terms. And all that prevents you from properly perceiving that you're dealing with multiple personality. And only if you can really, really go in there and wrench your mind open for just a minute, just try it for 1 minute, and try to allow that these mutually exclusive states of mind both exist there. Now, I'll tell you something that is in the book, and it happened. And so I sat down with him face to face, and this is before they kicked me out. And I said, John, why are you doing this? Why are you sending out all these letters to these people when you got me all winded up telling them you're an innocent framed cop? Why are you sending them these letters saying that that you're going to confess to homicides? And he said, you don't understand, because you're not a serial killer. And I'm like, well, you're right about that. Then he started trying to explain, and it really got through to me. And I don't know if it would get through to anyone else who hasn't actually been there, actually had to go through this. But it did get through to me. And he said this. He says, it's like you're in your room upstairs, and I'm down on the ground trying to get your attention, and I'm throwing rocks in your window, and you're picking the rocks up off the floor, and they're all different colors, and you can't figure out where they're coming from because they're all different colors. And so he kind of pauses. The guy leans forward. He stares me in the eyes. I can still see it now. And he speaks with pauses, like I'm going to speak now, and he says, they're different colors because they're coming from different places. And there was just something about that that opened up my mind to what I was dealing with, and I found it very useful later when I had to deal with Danny Rowling. And the thing about the images of the rocks that are different colors is that they are not, they don't mix. They don't mix. They're not a fluid. They're not a sand. They remain distinct. Each rock remains distinct from the other. And there are hard borders between them. And I just think if you could just get that image, I think sometime it might help you to understand what you're dealing with if you are dealing with one of these kind of people. I don't know. It just helped me.
In the writings, he talks extensively about his interactions with Ted Bundy, saying that Ted Bundy did some crimes in a copycat fashion, trying to emulate Schaefer, who he looked up to. Tell us a little bit more about these interactions with Ted Bundy that he had in Florida State Prison.
He says he did. Other people say he's lying. So, there. What can I tell you? I do know he was lying about the stuff he put out about Otis Toole. He put out this interview with Otis Toole that is still all over the net, and people believe it. And they'll quote it when they're talking about, like, ritual crime and everything. Oh, Otis Toole did this, Otis Toole. And it was written by Schaefer, and I could tell you that from 100 miles away. And Otis Toole doesn't have that kind of a florid imagination or ability to express himself. And surely Otis Toole had his own very, very profoundly disturbed case, but it wasn't what Schaefer said it was. It was all Schaefer saying that. As far as Bundy, it just fits Schaefer's grandiose profile to take something and build it up like that Dr. Seuss story and to say, and to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street. Do you remember that one? Each time he tells it, the story gets wilder and wilder. And to me, that's kind of like his creative process. Like when I told him that his characters weren't enough personality, he turns one into a real person and writes to real killers and says they should be killed. You see? So they say, well, Bundy was there. Oh, yeah, I was with him. You know? And nobody can really prove he was with him. I talked to his classification officer, and he said he could have been with him. He could have been transported with him or in permanent quarters with him. It could have happened.
Right.
And yet, it also could have not happened.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how much instigation went into trying to manipulate Otis Toole into admitting about Adam Walsh and giving all these details. Again, it sounds like Schaefer was involved in giving those kinds of details to a half-wit like Otis Toole.
Okay, no. No. I have an audio tape of Otis Toole before he even met Schaefer. And telling the details of what he did. That is a case that the public doesn't realize what's gone on. And let's see if I if I'll get in trouble for saying what I'm going to say, which is I investigated this case and I talked to the homicide detective who was in charge of the case. And his mouth to my ear was, John Walsh has never been cleared of complicity in his son's disappearance. That's number one. Number two, John Walsh and his wife Reva were carrying on one of those operations similar to what our friend Epstein was doing, where they were getting tape to blackmail people, sexual situations. And it just so happened that when the boy got snatched, Miss Reva was going on an assignation with the John. Okay, so therefore, police had to go into their little black book and interview all the people who had crossed into that operation. Okay, and that is what was in the police records. All those interviews with those Johns. Okay, in this whole situation that Walsh had going. But Walsh was a cash cow at Fox, and Fox sent in phalanxes of lawyers. They killed the story, okay? And my tape of Otis confessing to what he did was killed at that same time as the lawyers came and closed in on that. Because the tabloids filed a FOIA request, and they got those police records. They got them all right, but not a one published them. And they didn't publish the tape I have. And the tape is real. And I interviewed Otis myself, and he was very, very real about what he had suffered in the life of a ritual crime that he had endured was unbelievable. I'm just saying that Schaefer hijacked it. Mm. Okay, and there was another tape that I arranged of a tool where the guy said, what about Schaefer? Schaefer, he says, he's scared to death of me. He holds out his hand. He says, he's shaking just like this when he talks to me. Okay.
Why was that?
So look, here's what we've got. We've got a big bullshitter, okay? He's a con man and a bullshitter, and it's interesting to the true crime community because he is not just a casual bullshitter. He's not H.P. Lovecraft. He is a real criminal, and these are really the way his thoughts go. And it took someone like me to not allow it to be censored, because these thoughts are going on all the time. Probably other writers have uncovered material that's this disgusting, similarly disgusting, but they wouldn't publish it because they wanted to have a popular book that a lot of people would read. And this book, it's hard to read or hurt your feelings. And he just doesn't give anybody a break. And when I look at the way these people get all excited about, what if someone calls me the wrong pronoun for what I think I am, you know, I'm just like, look, honey, don't even pick up this book.
Yeah.
Okay, just don't even think about the title, the author, anything, because talk about your feelings being hurt. You know, you won't get through half a page. And it's really published in the interest of being research material for people who are seriously in need of understanding the criminal mind. Okay, it's not recreational. It's not a Disney ride where you get on, you feel a little woo woo woo, but you know you're safe. You know, and the ride's going to be over. It's not bad.
It's interesting, the themes that he has in the writing, though. I've seen disgusting material. Like I said, I've dealt with it myself. But this, he goes to great lengths to talk about and say that he researched executions and to see, and he's focused and interested in defecation and urination at the time
exactly.
of death.
Exactly.
So the kinds
well,
of, when we
no,
talk
no,
about
no,
disgusting.
No, full stop. He's interested in defecation, full stop. And here's the way I figured it. You know, we have that old cliche, I'll scare you to death.
Yeah.
But he'll try to just scare the shit out of you if he can. And, you know, then he's satisfied. And then I noticed this gal that he got caught where he tied her up and everything and she got loose. He put her on a fireman's carry over her shoulder. Well, that puts pressure on her abdomen, doesn't it? And that's really his payoff. And I can tell you this. I edited Schaefer, and I tried to influence Schaefer. I told Schaefer, look, John, I said, all that stuff about murder and killing, that's great. We like to hear about that. Will you go on into about pee-pee and caca? I says, we don't. I said, we are adults. We're grown. We're not interested in pee-pee and caca, okay? So just yeah. knock it off. Well, as soon as I tell him knock it off, of course he redoubles it. And so I find myself, well, look, John, you wrote it, I throw it away. That's what's going to happen. So just, if you're going to still continue to write that stuff, I'm still going to continue to throw it away. So believe me, I threw away a lot of it. And what you see in there, I only let it be in there if it absolutely was part of the plot line. Okay? Mm-hmm. And what you see, believe me, I've taken out five times as much.
Incredible.
Because I told him we're just this disgusting.
Yes, but it is
that
enlightening.
Huh?
It's very enlightening. I mean, we don't want to focus on disgusting.
I left it in there. You saw it.
Yes.
You saw it.
Yes.
I left it in there.
I just want you to know
that it was even worse than the original on the handwritten.
I can't even imagine. One thing that's very interesting we didn't talk about, and we need to talk about, is that part of this psychological attack on you eventually, and then, of course, the threats to you and your family, and then his denigration of you as a, called you the same word, whore as well, and a
sure.
cheat and a liar. In this, he also claims that you were the trigger, that your relationship was also a trigger. Explain that. What he had said to you.
I think it's true because among the papers that were in evidence, there was a letter. He had been arrested, and he was in jail. He hadn't been charged. And he wrote a letter to his mother, and he talked about his dear wife, Teresa. He was married to. That's a whole other story. Let's put that aside for now. And he talked about a girl who was his mistress at the time. Her name was Lynette. And he said, but the one I can't forget was Sandy. And he oh, geez. It had been, you know, 10 years. And he wrote that in his letter to his mother upon first being arrested, that I was the one he couldn't forget.
Wow.
I'll tell you a little bit about how we broke up. Maybe it's pertinent to criminological studies. I had some friends who happened to be boys. They were not any kind of romantic. They were just friends. And they didn't like Schaefer. And they had this cute guy that went to college nearby. And they said, let's introduce her to him. Maybe she'll fall for him. And they did, and I did. And he became my new boyfriend, cute as he could be. And he was a college boy, right? And I'm telling John, okay, well, that's it. You know, goodbye, so long, sayonara, baby, and so forth. His quote to me was, I'll get you back.
Wow.
Okay. You know, that I would never think in a million years that he meant anything other than he would like to be my boyfriend again. only in deep retrospect do I think of the double meaning between that and the other meaning of the phrase, I'll get you back. And then when I talked to him, had a conversation with him sometime in that following year, and he told me that he was hiding and watching when I came home from my date with my new boyfriend. We sat out in the car next. He told me he was out there watching me.
Jeez.
And that's when he used that phrase, I'll get you back. Okay, so that was kind of creepy. I mean, and it does tell you a little bit more about his whole criminal profile.
Yes. It's very interesting, too, in the letter, in the progression of the tone in the letters, where he starts off very, very, very confident and, of course, boasting and bragging. And then you negotiate this deal between you to write this book, and then at some point he believes you betrayed him, and then the tone changes to just outright threats and all his importance. But then at some point he also tries to then make amends with you.
He does.
And in the same, again, in the same month or in the same letter, again, threatening again. So.
That's right. That's
so it's
right.
A real...
Yep. And he continued to interfere with me. There was a case of Danny Rowling, who was in, quite popular in the newspapers and everything. And he's singing to me in court and whatnot, okay. And that day when Danny Rowling sang to me in court, little is known that that hearing was moved 3 times, okay. The hearing was scheduled to be held in one place, and I went there, and they said, it's been moved. And so I went to the other place. It's been moved. Okay, and I finally went to where they had it, and then they wouldn't kind of let me in. And they said, this is only for media. And I says, well, I am media. I'm reporting for a current affair. And their little local newspaper reporter that they knew so well, she said, she is. I've seen the story. Okay, and so they had to let me in. So they let me in. So there was one of the local reporters who told me this later, and he told me he had 3 sources on it. And he said the reason that was moved 3 times and all that was because they had word that Danny Rowling was going to break out. He was going to hold me hostage and break out, okay? And it was
right.
Schaefer. Schaefer told them that.
Yeah.
Schaefer told them that. Okay, but besides, that is the stupidest thing. Like, you don't have metal detectors, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you don't have a whole place full of armed guards, you know? And then someone else made the joke. If he was going to kidnap someone, why not kidnap someone that people cared about? Why her?
Oh, jeez.
Okay, but I'm just saying that's how far Schaefer kept on and on and on. I want to tell you one more thing. Remember I told you he was transferred over there to the Belgrade prison?
Right.
While he was there, he gave thought to filing a guilty plea to all his murders, and then he would tell me everything. And
right.
he said he didn't want to do that. Unless it was okay with his mom. So his mom and I came together to visit him at the prison. And I sat with them as he presented this to her and said, Mom, what if I plead guilty? Would it be okay with you and everything? And she pretty much said, yeah, sure, I don't care. You know, and so that was what he was supposed to do. He was supposed to plead guilty now because Mom said it wouldn't bother her.
Right.
But, you know, you have to see all this stuff goes on behind the scenes. You can only put so much in one book.
Yes, absolutely.
Why don't you tell us about plans for new editions of not only Killer Fiction, but the book you did about Danny Rowling? Tell us about what happened to enable you to be able to do this. Tell us a little bit about this and these new editions.
Thank you for asking, Dan. Both these books were published by Feral House, which was solely owned by Adam Parfrey. He died, and his sister, Jessica Parfrey, inherited the business. And meanwhile, Feral House never did one 5 cents worth of promotion of any of my books or any books. Only books they promoted were books that were written by Adam. And so the books just withered on the vine, and you let them go out of print. And I had complaints about both of those books, about the way they were typeset, and they never gave me a blue line proof to examine and just run them to print. And I said, no, not that, this. You know, I mean, look at this. Okay, they said, Adam said, well, we'll fix it on the second run. And what they did was never did a second run and left them like that, never advertised them. A lot of people would go looking for these books, couldn't find them. Even on the Feral House website, couldn't find them. Write to me and say, where can I get these books? And I send the letter to Feral House and say, look, people can't find the books and everything. So nothing happened. So anyway, now I put through a request, a formal request, and I got the copyright back from The Making of a Serial Killer, which is the book about Danny Rowling. And so I am right up to the end of that book. I'm going to put it out myself on Amazon, and I'm 99% done. I just have a couple of finishing touches to put on it. And that is going to be the second edition of The Making of a Serial Killer, which is the story of Danny Rowling. And it's pretty much like the first edition, folks, except there's a lot more illustrations and the typesetting conventions I established are now actually implemented instead of disregarded. And so it'll be better. But anyway, it'll be ready soon. And I like books. I don't care about e-books. So you'll be able to get an actual book of the Making of a Serial Killer really, 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 really soon, I promise. Then as soon as I get that out, I will complete the next volume beyond the Killer Fiction, because like I mentioned a minute ago, you do a lot of work on a case and only so much can go in a book.
That's
and
right.
That's twice as much for Danny Rowling. I have a ton of new material on Danny Rowling.
Great.
And I have it already compiled. I've already got 400 pages, but I have two interviews I want to do to add to it and with some more artwork. And that will come out afterwards. It's all, the cover's done, the blurbs are done. Oh, let's say probably 85% of the text is already in, typesetted and all. A little bit more to do on it. So those are really going to be coming out. As soon as I can get the second edition of The Making of a Serial Killer done, I will get that out. Then I will set to work finishing up beyond The Making of a Serial Killer. And what I'd like people to do who want to be notified about this, I have a website. It's called sandralondon.com. And on that website, you can see a lot of examples of my work. You can read them. And you can send me a message on the contact. And you can say, let me know when that book's coming out. And then you'll go on a list. And I will let you know when that book comes out. Now, once I get those two are like, you know, they're kind of like Siamese twins. Beyond the Making of a Serial Killer picks up where the other book leaves off.
Right.
So then after that, we'll get to Schaefer. And
absolutely.
They have a similar structure. I'm just going to do a second edition of exactly what we have here, but with some of the geez, I've been reading it over. There's so many typos. I could weep. But anyway, it'll just be pretty much what it is, except you can get it as a book,
yes,
which is what I like, books.
Yes.
And then after that, I will continue on with Beyond Killer Fiction, which is going to contain a lot of this story I left out, like what I was telling you about the freak trade, about the white... You know, when he... Let me just interject, if you don't mind. I know we're probably running out of time, but I'm jumping back.
Yes.
Remember when he tied up those two girls and they got away? Part
yes.
of what he was doing to terrorize them, wanted to cause fear, was telling them that it was about white slavery, and he was going to put them in white slavery. And John, in fact, did travel to Morocco, to five continents, plus Canada. Did a lot of traveling, and he kept saying it had something to do with white slavery. Well, again, you know, I didn't probe it. It just seemed to be grandiose and really beyond the scope of what I wanted to encourage him in. You know, I didn't want to get him off onto a wild thing when there were real cases here. So I kind of let it go. But I think it's historically relevant, and it would be good to have those on the public record, those things that he said were real. I mean, he wrote
Absolutely.
Them as fiction, but he also wrote me letters saying they were real.
Absolutely.
So that
it's,
kind of stuff is going to show up in the following volume.
We'll be looking forward to that.
Well, Dan,
I want to thank you
the
very
best.
Much.
I got to tell you, you're the best. You know, I sent out notices to a lot of people, and they've been on your show, and everyone wrote back how much they love you.
Oh, thank you. I have the best fans in the whole world, and I want to thank you and the audience for listening tonight. Thank you for coming on and talking about Killer Fiction, stories that convicted the ex-cop of murder. I want to thank you very much, Sandra London, and look forward to speaking to you again real soon about the Dandy Rowland case. I want you to have
a great
evening, and thank you
All
very
right.
much.
And thank your audience.
Thank you.
Bye.
Good night.